Anne Selby, Reel 3. Right, Anne, so here you are back in the new year. As you say, really stressed out, and you're having to face this the very big event, isn't it? The Gulf War, or the Gulf Crisis at that time.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
What were the events now leading to your leaving and flying off to the Gulf?
Well, of course, we... there were two of us going from the mess, two females going from the mess. Ironically, out of all of those men, it was two women who were going. And we were both... Sue McHale was a laundry permanent staff instructor. So she,
Sue McHale?
Sue McHale, her name was. McHale. M-C-H-A-L-E.
Mm-hmm.
She and I were going, and we were meant to be attached to a laundry platoon in Riyadh. And we flew out with that laundry platoon, basically. But prior to that, Sue and I, of course, both lived in the mess. And we were told, we'd assumed that, basically, we would just, because we were only going to sort of theoretically be there for a couple of months, theoretically, that we would just, you know, shut up our rooms and go. But we were told by the regimental sergeant major that we had to pack everything up into MFO boxes and they'd be held in storage. And so we knew from that that there was a little bit more to this than we realised. And we were quite perturbed about it. And there happened to be a chap on a course at Blackdown, because their employment training school did courses for regimental quartermaster sergeants. And they were all arms courses, which meant that they, you know, it didn't matter what unit they came from. There was this chap from 21 SAS, at Hereford, and he was down on the course, and he'd overheard the RSM giving us these orders, and overheard us talking about it, you know, and why we haven't packed the rooms up and everything. And he came over to the table and he said, ladies, he said, the bottom line is they don't expect you to come back alive. And just walked out, without saying anything else. And we asked him about it afterwards, and he said, and he wouldn't say anything else to us. You know, he kept saying, you can't just make a statement like that and then walk away. And he said, no, he said, they don't expect you to come back alive. And I knew as well from all of the stuff that had gone out from Donington and other stuff that had gone out, like body bags, and I also knew the preparation that the medical people had made, that hospital hospitals had been, you know, put on standby to receive enormous amounts of casualties. And I'll be perfectly honest with you that I don't believe we were meant to come back alive. I think they thought they would have thousands of casualties. Thousands. And I think that they were stunned when we all came back alive, and I think that was the cardinal sin of the Gulf War veteran, basically. The Gulf War people committed the sin of coming back alive because we were supposed to be dead, according to everything that had happened and all the information that they had, all the intelligence that they had. They really didn't expect us. They expected massive casualties. So I can see why, in a way, a person like that would say that, although, I mean, you know, you nearly always get people who give the impression that they have extra knowledge about things. But I think given the unit that this chap was attached to and the kind of intelligence that he might have been privy to, I think he told us as much as he did without, you know, disobeying orders or contravening any official secrets act or anything. And that was why he wouldn't say anything further. So I went out with that knowledge. I don't know whether Sue thought about it, because I didn't actually mention it to her again. And not long after we actually left for South Cerny, which is the RAF staging post.
Where is that?
RAF South Cerny is in Wiltshire. Is it in Wiltshire? Yes, I think it's in Wiltshire.
South Cerny?
South Cerny. It's C-E-R-N-E-Y.
Oh, yes.
And it's the staging post for, it's the, if you like, the airport terminal for Bryce Norton, which of course is the RAF airport that most of these flights, and that's where our flight was taking off from. Of course, we hadn't been told how we were flying, but we were actually kept at South Cerny for longer. We should have just literally been there all of our stuff had to go through transport and movement, so all of our kit, all of our weapons had to be bundled together in sacking, and all of our kit had to be, you know, put through transport and movement, who were run by the Royal Guard Transport at the time, and the military police. And then, of course, all of your stuff, literally like an ordinary airport, it was like having your baggage checked in. And then all you had with you was your webbing, your individual webbing, which is the pouches and stuff like that you wear over your uniform. And when we got there, we checked in all of our stuff, and we were all sitting around, and the warrant officer that was in charge of us, a guy called Ronnie Cooper, he had to go and find out what was happening. And he was away for ages, and everybody was just like hanging around. It was really strange because it was just like, you know, people were dozing in the chairs, and there was a television going, and, you know, very strange sort of feeling of unreality. It didn't feel like you were kind of, there was no buzz and excitement of going to war, you know, certainly not with some guys sort of snoring gently in the chair beside you and stuff like that. And then eventually Ron came back and he said, well, I don't really know what's going on, but he says, there's a rumour, he says, going around that the air bombardment is about to start. He says, and that may delay us flying out. So he said, I would prepare to be here for a night, at least.
That was at Bryce Norton,
that
was
at South Cerny.
Still at South Cerny.
Yeah. Mm. And in actual fact, we went away to get something to eat. And when we came back into this transit lounge thing where the television was, the air bombardment had actually started. And the guy from the BBC was basically announcing it and commentating on as the air bombardment started. And of course, you know, that was the first kind of buzz of excitement that anybody knew, you know, it's begun, you know, sort of thing. And I just remember feeling absolutely sick to my stomach because I tried to call my kids and couldn't talk to them, basically, you wouldn't let me talk to them. They were on the extension upstairs and he was on the bottom phone and he was saying, you can't go, if you go I'll kill myself. And I was saying things like, I'm sorry, you know, if that's the way you feel, then you're just going to have to go ahead and do it because, you know, I don't have a choice. And I could hear my kids breathless on the extension, you know, and I'm trying to shout above him as he's yelling and I'm having to say to them, boys, please, I love you, I'll come back safe. Please look after yourselves, look after each other, I love you very much. You know, and I'm trying to shout this over him. And I remember putting the phone down and it was just like, I can tell you exactly how I felt. I felt like I just literally sunk into the middle of this black abyss. That's how I felt. I felt like I was in a bottomless pit. And it didn't even, you know, the sight of the flashing of the weapons and from the air bombardment didn't do anything to me at all. It didn't give me an excited buzz. I just felt sick to my stomach. I really did.
And that was your home situation, not the war that made that sickness.
Yes, because I didn't really have time to feel sick about the idea of the war, because I was so worried about what was going on at North. And the only thing that I could do was to ring my friend Mal in Wiltshire, in Wilton, where she was in Wilton near Salisbury, and ask her if she could please keep ringing, and could she check on them to see if they were okay? And she promised to do that for me while I was away, because I didn't know when I'd be able to get in touch again. And we eventually were given the go-ahead to go to Bryce Norton. We were bused to Bryce Norton at about 7:15 the following morning. And that
would be the 18th then, would it? The 18th of January?
I believe it was the 18th, yes. No, it would have been earlier. No, it wasn't the 18th. We actually, the air bombardments started earlier than the 17th. I'll tell you how I know that, was because the day that I arrived in Riyadh was my 20th wedding anniversary.
And what date was that?
17th of January, I was married.
So that's when you arrived in Riyadh,
yes.
Was it?
So the air bombardment must have started on the night of the 16th, because we arrived the next day. I don't remember exactly when it started, but I do know that I had my wedding anniversary in Saudi Arabia because I thought how ironic it was. And everything was ironic for me at that stage. And, you know, we literally flew, I mean, we flew Kuwaiti Airlines, believe it or not. There we are at Bryce Norton, and squaddies are amazing. I mean, they just are amazing. It doesn't matter where they go. You know, there's like this little kind of tuck shop area with, you know, where they could buy sweeties and magazines. And there they were, you know, buying sweeties and magazines. And, you know, it didn't matter where a squaddie was. You'd still want a bag of crisps and a can of Coke and a newspaper. And there were people who had spent the night in the bar and, you know, they were drunk, and I sat next to this one guy who was totally, I tried to make conversation with him, but he answered in monosyllables, you know, and I just took it that he kind of tried to anaesthetise himself to the idea, and so he wasn't really there, but he also didn't look well, and I thought, I'm not quite sure about the value of anaesthetising yourself when you suffer for it the next day, you know. I was having the most monstrous hangover in the world, and I thought, I'm not sure that I wouldn't rather be just, you know, fairly alert. And so, I mean, it was just like very strange. It was like we didn't look like a kind of spiffy, spanking new army ready to go, you know, weapons at the ready. And you know how they always put these pictures of the American Marines and they're marching smoking onto the thing, and we're all sprawled about in this terminal lounge, so to speak, at Bryce Norton. And what we looked like was a bunch of very badly dressed travellers on their way to Benidorm, you know. That's what we looked like, soldiers. And we all traipsed onto this plane, and everything in those circumstances, because everything was so horrific for me personally, I was noting the strangest things with amusement, like how all of the smokers went to the back of the plane, and they all sat around back, and I don't know if you remember when you were at school, all of the people who had attitude and had these charmed circles, they all sat at the back of the class. And of course, I was never one of them because I wore glasses and I had to sit at the front. So I was never one of the charmed circle. These people all gravitated to the back, and then there was me and a couple of others kind of sat round the front. And I was sat next to an RAF flight lieutenant who was going over. And halfway through the flight, the Kuwaiti Airlines people had been handed noddy suits and respirators. Because obviously they didn't know what they were flying into, and they came and they asked the military if somebody would actually show them how to kit up and wear it. So we're on an aircraft flying to Saudi Arabia into a war. They pull down the cinema screen, but instead of showing us a film which would have diverted our attention, you know, from what the horrific things that might happen, they wouldn't show a film. All they had was this map of Saudi to show our progress towards our impending doom, presumably. And in the middle of all of this, some NBC instructor types are busy giving the crew of the airline an on-the-spot lesson in how to put protective clothing on. And I was sat there thinking, this is not real. This is not real. This is not how they show it in the movies. Anyway, we arrived in Saudi airspace, and I knew it was Saudi airspace. I was sat next to the window, and I had the blind thing pulled up. And I suddenly saw this jet appear. And I looked, and I was on eye level with the pilots. And he smiled at me. That's how close he was. I could actually see him. And he smiled at me. And I kind of looked at the other side. The other window was at right across the other side. And I just saw that there was one on the other side. So they were literally fighters escorting us into Saudi airspace. And I remember getting the attention of the flight lieutenant next to me, because we'd have obviously conversation throughout the flight, and I said, there's Klingons on the starboard bow, and he literally burst out laughing. And that was how we got into Riyadh. Literally, we were laughing at the whole thing, and of course, by this time, we knew. I mean, we saw the fighters, we were told, it was announced over the radio that we were flying into more or less a controlled zone, you know. And that we, basically, the chances of an alert coming were very strong, and that if there was an alert, we had to kit up, even inside the airplane, we had to kit up, respirators, everything. And of course, now by this time, it is really sinking home, really sinking home. And I'm looking at my respirator is on one side, and I'm thinking, okay, can I get this open quickly enough? My hands, and I tried to get it open from the wrong side, and you know, everything was just completely sort of, you know, threw you into a complete loop. And then, of course, we landed. And when we landed, they obviously didn't put, they just put the steps down from the plane, and we, all of our gear was literally just thrown out into the tarmac. And we all kind of stood around waiting for somebody to come and tell us what was going on, and everybody was in the general melee, and you were trying to find your own kit. And we were eventually all led over to this huge building. And what we could see was that we landed in an airport as such, but it looked like a partly built airport. And I found out afterwards, in actual fact, that's what it was. They started to build this part of the airport. Then, in true Saudi fashion, they got bored and decided to build another airport next door. So we were occupying this kind of half-made airport, which had never been an airport. So it was part building site, part airport. It had enough facilities to enable planes to land and to be refueled and such. But there was huge hangar-like buildings which were meant to originally be like huge lounge areas. They even started to put the chairs in and such like. You know, it was very strange. But it was all dark. There was no light. And we literally were all taken upstairs to this huge, cavernous, dark room. And we were all told to put our kit down. And then these people just loomed up, these officers just loomed up from nowhere. And this sort of sepulchral voice said, "Welcome to Saudi Arabia, ladies and gentlemen. We do not have an alert at the moment, but if the sirens go off, you'll be required to kit up. You were issued with pyridostigmine bromide naps, nerve agent pre-treatment set tablets. We require you to take them now." And we were told to get our water bottles out, and they literally stood over us while we took them.
These are the nap tablets?
Naps tablets, which were pyridostigmine bromide. Nerve agent pre-treatment set is what NAPS stands for. And they stood over us while we took them. And we were told that we would be told when to take them throughout the day, and that we must not take them. So we all dutifully swallowed the NAPS tablets. And then everybody kind of just disappeared off in various directions. And our little unit, of course, nobody knew where we were supposed to go. But because we were laundry platoons attached to the hospital, we assumed that because the hospital was in the basement and the ground floor of this huge hangar-like building, we would just toddle down there and see what was happening. And when we got to this hospital, of course, nobody knew who we were or why we were there. So one of the medics very kindly said, "Look, you all look a bit shattered. We've made up all these hospital beds. You and your unit, just take a bed and just get some kip. And, you know, we'll see what happens." Anyway, we all sit down onto these beds, and fully dressed, of course. And I think we'd been lying there about maybe 10 minutes when the sirens went off. And this is the second horrifically humorous thing that came across to me in the military. We'd all had this training to get this kit on. And of course, we were a mixture of regular and TA personnel, but we'd all have the same training. And we were all under stress to get this kit on. And I don't know if you've ever seen a noddy suit, but it comes in two parts. It comes in a jacket and a trousers. And the trousers have two straps, which actually come from the back, down the front, and they cross across the front, and then you take them through and fasten them around the back. And then you have to put on, you've got your respirator, the noddy suit has a hood which you pull over and tighten, because no air is allowed to get through. Then you have two sets of gloves. You have a white set and a black rubber set. And you have a set of over boots to go over your boots. So you're literally encased completely. And you have got to get your respirator and this kit on in seconds. And of course, we'd all practice like mad, as you might imagine. You know, given the motivation of actually living, we got it on. And so, but bear in mind also that some of these young TA people were just young lads. I mean, one of them was just barely young. The guy that was next to me, I think he was no more than about 18 or 19. And the sirens went off, and I remember panicking and jumping off the bed. And I couldn't get this roll undone. I felt like my fingers had turned into huge bunches of bananas. And I couldn't get the ripped it open, and I managed to get my trousers on. And I put my respirator on, obviously, first, blew out hard, got my trousers on, and of course, I couldn't find the ties. And I'm thinking, where are the ties? And so I gave up. And I put on, and I put my gloves on. And of course, I made the mistake of trying to put my overboots on when I got the black gloves on, because the black gloves made your fingers even bigger, so you couldn't get the things through, the laces through the holes of the overboots. And I'm struggling, and all I could hear around me was, of course, when you've got the gas mask on, everybody sounds like Darth Vader. So all you could hear was, and sounds of gasping and groaning and oh, and swearing and, you know, and things being dropped. And then the all clear sounded. And of course, when I actually looked up, it had to be the funniest sight that I've ever seen in my life. All around me were people in various stages of NBC dress. Some had the respirators on, some just had the jacket on, some had over boots on, some had the respirator and nothing else, you know. And the young guy beside me in the bed, he was literally just stood there. He didn't have any of it on, he had his respirator in one hand, and he literally looked like a rabbit caught in the headlights. He was just literally just staring. I mean, he'd taken off the Jupiter and he was going to remain there for the duration, I think. You know, and you could see this little pool of spittle had collected in the side of his mouth. And of course, the warrant officer turned around and said, you'll have to excuse me because I am going to swear here, but it's what he said was funny. He said, "Well, what a fucking shambles." He said, "If there had been any nerve agent in that, you'd all be dead." And he yelled the last word out. And of course, upon the word dead, this poor little lad who was transfixed beside me, it must have been the only word that struck him. And he literally came to life, and he was like looking all around him, and his hands, and he was patting his body as if thinking, well, maybe bits have dropped off during the course. The warrant officer saw him and stood in front of him, and he said, "Well, thank you for joining us, Private." And then he said, "Somebody show him how to put his kit on, would you?" And that was our first, I mean, we were in shambles. And the reason I couldn't find my the stuff to tie the trousers with was because I had my trousers in the back of the front. And I tried to say this to this young lad because he was absolutely mortified. I said, "Well, look," I said, "I wasn't much better." I said, "My trousers were on back to front." And he says, "Yeah, no stuff." But he says, "At least you have most of your kit on." He's not got any of it on. And I think that in itself is an absolutely wonderful example of how a situation like that does affect people in reality. Because nobody's like John Wayne. Nobody's like the depiction of the American marines. They, running up and fighting, firing from the hip. And, you know, I think the recent film Saving Private Ryan of Steven Spielberg's was probably that opening scenes of them getting slaughtered on the beach is actually more like reality than this, you know, gung-ho marines and, you know, they're going to go in there and kick ass and stuff like that. Everybody might think that they're like that, but we're actually all human beings. And the thing that I wrote in a letter to my sons afterwards was, I said, "Fear, when you read sentences in books like, 'She could taste the fear,' I said, trust me, fear does have a taste. It tastes like metallic blood in the back of your throat. And fear makes your heart feel like it's going to burst through your throat. And that's what it, fear does have a taste. Because that is the first time in my entire life that I had actually tasted real fear. Not just scared to go to the dentist fear. Fear of, oh my God, you know, if I don't do this in the right way, I'm going to die. Fear. And I think that's important, that humans react. Humans don't react in the way that Hollywood depicts them. They react in, they do stupid things. They don't get their kit on right. They put things on back to front. They freeze. The primary emotions in a human being are fight, freeze, or flee. Those are the things that motivate us all. They're the three most basic emotions, and that is nowhere more obvious than in that incident. As funny as it was, and it was funny, but it was also very, very realistic, I think. You know, and when I sit and listen to soldiers, Second World War soldiers and such like talking, and they kind of come up with the war stories, that story always floats up to mind, and I always give that story out, and I have made people laugh, but I've also made them look at me as if to say, we can't be real soldiers, you know, real soldiers don't do that, and my contention is real soldiers do that, I believe, you know, real soldiers are human beings. Anyway, that's just my thoughts on the matter, but, you know, here I am, a woman in the middle of all of this male-dominated macho thing, you know, and I'm seeing the funny side of things.
And just two of you were there still, two women?
Yes.
In this group, yes. Just the two of you.
Mm. Just two, yeah. And we didn't get treated any differently by the guys. I mean, they were a great bunch of guys, honestly. They were smashing. And unfortunately, I did not actually stay with them all that long. They didn't really have a place for me, in actual fact. I'm not even sure why they required me in the first place. But about 2 days into the yard, I was taken aside by the warrant officer and told that because they had three young WRAC at the other unit in Al-Jabbar, at 22 General Hospital, 33 General Hospital, they were Al-Jabbar, and they didn't come see me around, and apparently they were having a few problems with them. And I was literally told that I was moving further forward. So I was sent 2 days later from Riyadh to Al-Jabbar, which, of course, Riyadh was about 300, 400 kilometres away from the front line. Al-Jabbar was only 150 kilometres away from the front line. And we were in the, what they call the forward maintenance area. And I was sent there to look after them, because even when I got there, they really didn't have any use for an admin clerk. And at the finish, because they didn't have any use for me, I actually got drafted into helping the HQ 1 Armed Signal Regiment, their quartermaster, who was the quartermaster for the whole of the forward maintenance area. And that was what I ended up doing. It was myself and a few other, about two or three other staff sergeants and a sergeant and a corporal. And we were part of his staff, the quartermaster's staff, and we literally did everything. You know, from
the ROAC.
Weren't ROAC, in actual fact.
Oh, weren't they?
They were a mixture. I mean, the actual quartermaster was a Coldstream Guardsman. The RSM was a Gurkha. The regimental quartermaster sergeant was Royal Artillery, as was the young corporal. And then there was the Royal Artillery sergeant. Then there was myself, who was ROAC. And then there was a guy from the Queen's Royal Irish Hussars.
But it was basically supplies, was it?
Well, in fact, we didn't just do supplies. We did almost everything. We did everything for the whole area. We did administration for a lot of the units, because they were the central point of supply and the central point of administration, really, in many ways, for a lot of the units that got up front. Not all of the units, but, you know, they were all reliant upon this central office to do things. And that's basically what we did. We did everything from from armed escorts to local procurement. So it was a wide-ranging range of duties, basically.
This place where you were,